This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. After being dormant for decades, the musical Bye Bye Birdie suddenly is current again. Its film version figured prominently in a recent episode of the period TV series Mad Men. And the stage musical itself, with music by Charles Strauss and lyrics by Lee Adams, is being revived on Broadway for the first time since its 1960 premiere. It's a show about an Elvis-type singer who stages a publicity stunt to meet a member of a local fan club. From the original Broadway cast, here are Dick Gauthier as pop star Conrad Birdie and Susan Watson as his lucky fan, singing A Lot of Livin' to Do.
There are chicks just ripe for some kissing, and I mean to kiss me a few. Man, those chicks don't know what they're missing. I got a lot of living to do. Sizzling steaks all ready for tasting, and there's Cadillacs all shiny and new. Gotta move, 'cause time is a-wasting. There's such a lot of living to do.
There are men of 19 or 20 who are suave and reckless and true. Older men who give a girl plenty. I've got a lot of living to do.
There's music to play, places to go, people to see, everything for you and me. Crazy clothes and motorboat races.
A Lot of Livin' to Do, one of the songs in Bye Bye Birdie. The Roundabout Theater production revival, starring John Stamos and Bill Irwin, opens next week on Broadway. To note the occasion, we're revisiting Terry's 1994 interview with Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for Birdie, and for the musicals Applause, Golden Boy, and the mega hit Annie. They started by talking about Broadway's original Bye Bye Birdie, which starred Dick Van Dyke, Cheetah Rivera, and Paul Lynde, and featured such songs as Kids, Put on a Happy Face, and Honestly Sincere.
I had to tell you, I was listening to the album again last night, and I hadn't heard the score in a long time, and I was just shocked to realize that I remembered words to songs when I'd completely forgotten the song existed, like Normal American Boy. I mean, I haven't thought about that song in years, and I realized, God, I know all the words to this. And I bet so many people have that reaction when they hear songs from Bye Bye Birdie.
Yes, fortunately they do. It's a very, very much performed show. At the time, Lee Adams and Mike Stewart and I wrote it. We wrote it because it was offered us, you might say. We would have written, I guess, almost any show that was offered us. It actually wasn't even in that shape. It was just to be a show about teenagers. But had we realized that it would have that kind of commercial clout, that is, that high schools and camps and prisons, I don't know, everybody does it. It's incredible. And it keeps picking up in performances. I think we would have said, oh, let's do that show. But at the time, it was just... It was actually even a little strange. It was a bit of an embarrassment in a funny way to me and to Mike, because, well, to me particularly, because I had I'd been in serious music all my life. I'd studied classical music. I was embarking on a serious music career, that this would be the first opportunity that I'd have for a major public hearing. And then that we had this silly name, Bye Bye Birdie, it was not the show that I wanted to write, which taught me something about myself, which is I don't know where the hell I am half the time.
Let me ask you about writing the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie. And this is a series of phone conversations that the teenagers are having with each other. And it's not a straightforward song. I mean, you're basically setting a series of conversations to music with little interruptions and phones right. ringing. So what were some of your considerations when you were writing the music for that?
Well, you know, before I just answer that, I have four kids, and it's come back to haunt me because I have four telephone lines, and it's still every second everybody's on the phone. Anyway, beside the point, my considerations were, first of all, that it was rock, and of its sort, it is rock music, though such an innocent sort that, you know, I don't like to listen to it and say I'm Mick Jagger or anybody like that. But it was rock, and I paid attention very strongly to the guitar chords, you know, that all guitarists play on it. You know, a lot of rock music in those days particularly was very, I don't want to say simple because that wouldn't, that would be a little bit derogatory, but there were certain patterns. It became patterned in a way, and I did model it on that. But then I used a lot of... I used a lot of changes of time and a lot of interjections, which is into the exact rock beat. But I kept the beat going very much, and then I used Lee and I sat and kind of carved it out together, high and you know the things. Did they really get pinned?
Well, here's the telephone hour from Bye Bye Birdie, music by my guest Charles Strauss.
Johnson, can I speak to Penelope Ann?
You know about Kim.
Penelope?
I just knew it somehow.
About the prom?
I must call her right up.
Saturday?
I can't talk to you now.
The Telephone Hour, from the original cast recording of Bye Bye Birdie. The cable series Mad Men built a plot line around Bye Bye Birdie earlier this season, when some of the copywriters for the advertising agency were eager to copy a scene from the film version to help sell a new Diet Cola called Patio. The idea was to hire someone to sing directly to the camera, all bubbly and full of sex appeal, as Anne Margaret had done playing a teenaged fan in the film version. But one member of the team, Peggy, played by Elizabeth Moss, doesn't like the idea as much as the men in the room.
Is there more?
I love her.
I saw Susan Watson do it on Broadway, and she was great. But she didn't have that.
Well, it's not going to be her. But they want that scene frame for frame, as they say.
So, something about how desperate she is for a Pepsi?
It's for Pepsi, but it's not for Pepsi. It's called Patio. and it's a dieter's kind of Pepsi to help women reduce. It's Pepsi's Diet Right Cola, and there's claims that their lawyers went over calories, etc. If we do it right, we land patio, and if we land patio, I'll be at lunch with Pepsi.
I think Pete Campbell just broke a sweat.
I'm coming to casting.
We're going right to casting?
You don't have to if you don't want to.
I understand why. You like this, but it's not for you. I'm the one who'd be buying patio.
You're not fat anymore.
Thank you. Let's assume we can't talk them out of the name. And let's assume we can get a girl who can match Anne Margaret's ability to be 25 and act 14.
Is that what she's doing?
Is it just a knockoff? Are we allowed to make fun of it at least?
She's fun and sexy. Don't be a prude.
Would you say that to me?
It's sexy, and it's what they want.
Clients don't always know what's best.
When we land them, you can start talking to them that way.
A scene from the AMC series Mad Men, discussing a scene in the movie version of Bye Bye Birdie. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Charles Strauss, who wrote the music for Bye Bye Birdie, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1994 interview with Charles Strauss, composer of the music for Bye Bye Birdie. A Broadway revival of the musical opens next week.
You studied with Nadia Boulanger. Did she give you any advice about pop music versus classical music?
Well, oddly enough, she did. This woman was the great musician of our generation in many ways, and her greatness was that she was a master analyst, not only of music but a psychoanalyst in her own way. And she used to hear the music of her students, and she was able to isolate it. She was able to shine a spotlight on what was you and what was watered down Stravinsky. I remember when I worked with her, she asked to hear everything I'd written, and I played her my sonata and my concerto and various things, art songs and all that. And she said, well, what else? And I said, well, that's it. She said, well, no, what about, you know, your student pieces? And I played her some of them. And then anything else? And I said, well, there was my parents, who were never into serious music at all, though they were very proud of me. I used to come home from college and play them all these pieces that sounded like watered down Bartok, really, but it was very serious kind of things. I was really, you know, into it, and I could see they were proud of me, but they didn't really
respond.
Yeah, not really. I mean, I think so. My mother was just always so nervous for me. But I remember writing a piece that I considered my party piece that I could play that they could show off to my aunt. I had an aunt Stella, who she was hard of hearing to begin with, but it was she was over at the house a lot, and I wrote this piece, and it was really, you know, I look back at it today, kind of saucy or something. It was very lighthearted, and they loved it. Everybody liked it, so it became my piece, and I played that for her, which I very rarely, I didn't do that for anybody except, you know, a couple of relatives, and she said, well, what else? And I said, well, when my brother, he had been in the Navy, and when he came home from his first tour of duty, or his boot camp, whatever, I had written, I laugh because it was a funny moment in my life, and I said, I wrote this little song for him called Welcome Home, Able-Bodied Seaman Strauss, see? And she said, may I hear that? Oh, I said, I could. No, she said, please. And so there, with this venerable woman, I played this silly song. She said, I see. She said, anything else? And I said, this makes me laugh. I said, I used to go out with a girl. I really liked her. Her name was Janet. And we lived on the Upper West Side of New York. And I wrote this song, but it was a joke called Moon Over 83rd Street. She said, play this for me. Here I am in Paris, you know, with an intimate of Stravinsky's and every American composer that you could think of having studied with this great woman. So I played Moon Over 83rd Street. And she said, good. Now we go back to this, whatever. So we went back to... towards the end of my thing, she said to me something that nobody had ever said to me. She said that you have a great talent for light music.
May I make a request?
Sure.
Could you sing one of the songs that you played for her?
Wait a second. The Welcome Home, Mabel Montesquieu. What else? You heard that? No, I can't sing that one. Moon Over. Oh, Moon. This is the funniest interview I've ever done. Moon Over 83rd Street with shafts right below. A moon over 83rd Street, my heart's all aglow. You, Janet, in the lamplight, I hear something call. I hear something dull. I'm yours, body and soul. I think that was the last one. It was meant partly as a jest. I mean, but that was it. There's a first performance for you.
So, but it helped you. It helped you find out that that's what you should be doing. Is writing pop tunes.
That was her genius. That's why I can laugh at it. I can also laugh at it because I've had some successful shows. But her genius was really taking a young kid like me. I was quite young when I was there. I was around 18 or so, and I know from my own experience with my own children what it is to be searching for an identity. And she, in her soft, brilliant way, was able to contribute to my identifying who I was.
Mm-hmm. I want to close with the story behind one of your most famous songs, and this is the song from Annie, Tomorrow. Did you have to write in a range that you were confident a kid could sing?
Well, that's really an interesting question because yes and no. The yes is a part of my musical background. I know what kids' ranges and sopranos and tenors are. The no part is that I wanted to squeeze a little bit more out of them because the emotional part of the music is when kids sing high, they scream. You know, I did it in Bye Bye Birdie, and in Bye Bye Birdie, they sang notes in the telephone hour that they didn't think they could sing. And actually, I had learned a lot of that. I used to work for Frank Lesser. I was his assistant for 2 years. And I remember when Frank was testing people for range, he would often have them sing
from Bushel and a Peck.
From Bushel and a Peck. And because it was, he would put it in a key with the pianist that it would be out of their range. They had to go, but because they were making fun, they could or could not hit it. Had you said, sing that note legitimately in a song like, I don't know, If I Loved You or something, they would have said they can't reach it. But when they were playing these characters, they could. So I devised, it's not my own invention, but or maybe it is, I don't know. These kids would come in, and I would just have them sing Happy Birthday. Once they passed the other thing, I would have them sing a song that they didn't have to worry about anything. And so they would, Happy Birthday, Happy Birthday. See, and very often they found that they could reach notes which on their resumes they couldn't reach at all, and that was the sound I wanted. So I did write for that, and particularly in a song like Hard Knock Life and in Tomorrow, the song Tomorrow. And what happened was that at the very beginning, during our auditions, nobody could sing these songs. Today, every girl in the world sings them, which is it's a wonderful, actually, tribute to the psychology and any popularity the songs have.
Well, let me say it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Terry. For me, it's great.
Charles Strauss speaking to Terry Gross in 1994. The first ever Broadway revival of Bye Bye Birdie opens next week. Here's Charles Strauss himself, recorded at the Smithsonian in 1978, performing and telling a story about one of the famous songs from Bye Bye Birdie. I'm David B. Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
I just wanted to do a couple of songs that might show you some of the things that happened, which were a result of the staging or the underlying dramatics, the performers, the costumes. They all had an effect on these songs. First, there was a song that was in Bye Bye Birdie. It involved what we thought was a terribly clever idea. We had Dick Van Dyke, and there was a moment in the play in which he was very depressed and had to set up a television show, the Ed Sullivan Show, and he was working with the lighting man who was throwing different color spots on him, and he would be in and out of them dancing, singing in and out of these spots. He would also be able to express what was inside him and be able to dance, and it was a number right up Gower Champion's alley, who was the director. We couldn't miss with this number. A big hit, right? No, wrong. It was a real flop, and we couldn't understand it. For some reason, it didn't work. We thought there was nothing else to do but throw out the song, which is Lee's and my habit. We're very impatient with a song not working. But it was Marge Champion, Gower's then wife, who had what I thought was the corniest idea in the world, put it in a spot in the first act where he sang the song to two little girls who were very depressed at seeing their hero, Conrad Bertie, leaving for the army. But we tried it, and magically, it worked right away. And you could tell, this was a spot where the audience wanted to see Dick Van Dyke dance. They wanted to see this happen with two little funny, wonderful-looking girls who were depressed, and the number went on to become one of the great successes in the show. Anyway, here was the number.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face. Brush off the clouds and cheer up, put on a happy face. Take off that gloomy mask of tragedy, it's not your style. You look so good that you'll be glad you decided to smile. Pick out a pleasant outlook, stick out that noble chin.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Dan Shaun's novel, Among the Missing, was a finalist for the National Book Award. Book critic Maureen Corrigan can't decide whether his latest novel, Await Your Reply, should be given an award or a lie detector test.
Dan Shaun's latest novel, Await Your Reply, came out at the end of August, traditionally a stagnant period in the publishing calendar, and so a logical time to feature this work of literary fiction by a writer who has his devoted followers, but by no means is a best-selling big name. But sales considerations aside, autumn, with its mists and early nightfalls, would have been a more seasonally appropriate choice for this elegantly chilly novel about identity theft and existential confusion. Shaun's emotionally austere architectural plot demands that readers keep their wits about them. And just to make sure that his readers are alert, eyes front from the get-go, Shaun opens his novel on the scene of a teenaged boy named Ryan struggling to maintain consciousness in a car being driven by his panicked father. On the seat in between them is a styrofoam ice cooler that contains Ryan's severed hand. It's a scene straight out of a Halloween movie, but the story behind it is even more mundanely disturbing. Ryan's tale is one of three intertwined narratives that compose Await Your Reply. All of them are bleak and weird and slyly compelling. Ryan, we learn, has been drawn into a career of credit card fraud by his father, a biological father he's only recently discovered after learning that he was adopted at birth. The second, and to my mind most intriguing story, focuses on another lost teenager, a girl named Lucy, who's just graduated from high school and has left her Ohio town in the middle of the night with her former history teacher, a charismatic guy named George Orson. They hole up for weeks at a long-shuttered motel complex in Nebraska that George claims was owned by his family. Think the landscape of Psycho, because that's what Shaun invites us readers to think. Shaun also winks throughout this heavily allusive novel to the work of other cultured creepmeisters like Joyce Carol Oates, Mary Shelley, Edgar Allan Poe, and H.P. Lovecraft. In the third tale of this unholy trinity, a man named Miles has been searching for a decade for his twin brother Hayden, who suffers, perhaps, from schizophrenia. Miles believes he's finally closing in on his demonic double at an abandoned scientific research station in the Arctic. Throughout the novel, Shaun keeps transporting us to fantastic landscapes like that one. Some are all too real, like Las Vegas. Others could be. Near that deserted motel where Lucy and George are hiding, for instance, is a sprawling, dried-up reservoir, which was originally created by flooding a town, Nebraska's own version of Atlantis. It seems that neither places, nor stories, nor human identities are stable in this spinning nebula of a novel. As you might expect with a writer who toys so obsessively with the idea of the self as free-floating rather than fixed, old-fashioned character development is not a major concern here. Indeed, in the course of Await Your Reply, a reader learns the hard way not to get attached to any of these characters, since, to varying degrees, they show themselves to be not quite who we, or sometimes they, first think they are. Intelligence is the draw here, demonstrated by the seemingly infinite number of riffs the novel can generate on the theme of multiple identities. In a reflective and unintentionally funny moment, Jay, Ryan's credit card thief dad, explains to him the more philosophical attractions of stealing other people's identities. "I can't understand how people can settle for having just one life," Jay says. "I remember we were in English class and we were talking about that poem by that one guy, David Frost, Two Roads Diverged in a Yellow Wood. You know this poem, right? I love that poem, but I remember thinking to myself, why? How come you can't travel both roads? That seemed really unfair to me." Sean cements his smarts in the novel's final pages with an ending that clicks shut like a coffin lid. You won't be saddened by that ending, but unless you're made of tougher stuff than I am, you will be startled.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Await Your Reply by Dan Sean. Tonight in San Francisco, musicians and jazz fans will gather for a concert paying tribute to jazz trumpeter Lester Bowie. Next month will mark the 10th anniversary of his death. His musical legacy will be saluted tonight by such performers as James Carter and members of the Art Ensemble of Chicago, which was co-founded by Bowie more than 40 years ago. Lester Bowie was both a great jazz scholar and a great showman. He was enthusiastic about all kinds of music, from avant-garde jazz to R&B and doo-wop, and he recorded playful, wonderful versions of everything from the Howdy Doody Show theme song to The Great Pretender. Terry Gross spoke to Lester Bowie in 1989.
Playing rhythm and blues standards with the band?
Well, when I first started playing professionally at age 15, I played with a group called the Continentals that was backing up a lot of doo-wop groups during that time. This is 1954 to 59. And one of the first songs that I learned was The Great Pretender. So assuming that jazz always expounded on contemporary music, I was always confused as to why jazz guys never really picked up on what was happening for the doo-wop guys in the 50s. So to pick up that slack and to fill that space, I decided to do it myself.
Did you ever turn your back on those songs yourself because they weren't jazz and you were a jazz musician?
No, I've always been a professional musician first. I always tell any student that I have that if you want to be a jazz musician, you first have to learn how to feed yourself with the instrument. After that, you can specialize. And another thing, we in jazz aren't supposed to be so closed-minded as to turn our backs on any kind of music.
Did playing with people like Solomon Burke and Jackie Wilson, Rufus Thomas, Gladys Knight, Patti LaBelle, give you a sense of the theater of music?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. And it taught me a lot about staging and just how music moves and how it affects people.
Did you do steps and wear jackets, and did you have synchronized horn movements?
I did the steps. We wore the jackets, but I didn't like the fast moves. You know, one time I auditioned for James Brown. Actually, I auditioned three times. I never got the gig, but I was always glad I didn't because I didn't want to flip my trumpet around like that. I was scared. That's the only trumpet I had.
Well, you mentioned James Brown. You do Papa's Got a Brand New Bag on your new record. Tell me why you chose that one.
James Brown has been one of the influential people in music for the last, since I was in high school, since 1955. And this is just part of our homage and our respect for his music and what he's done for jazz and what it's done for rhythm and blues, what it's done for the rap music of today. He's truly the godfather of soul.
About your playing. You tend to play in the cracks between notes a lot, and you do these flub notes that are perfectly controlled. You know exactly, or you seem to know exactly how you're going to miss a note. And I was wondering how you develop that kind of technique.
Well, I used to tell people I've built a whole career off making mistakes. What I do is, if I make a mistake, I just learn how to do it on purpose. So then I've got the note that I should have hit, then I get the note that I didn't hit, but I know how to make both of them on purpose.
Well, do you think of yourself as having a lot of technique as a player?
Well, I've probably got the most advanced technique in brass as far as the newer elements that I use. I don't have the best by any means as far as the standard trumpet classical technique, but who cares?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever care?
Nope, Fred, not. At the time, my father was a classical musician. Trained as a classical musician in the 30s, and when he came up, there was no hope of a black man ever getting any, being with the symphony orchestra in the States, so I didn't even consider that. It was never part of my, never part of it. Mm-hmm. Plus, the music kind of bored me a little bit, too.
We were talking before about the theatricality of music and the matching jackets that you'd have to wear when you were playing with rhythm and blues bands and doo-wop groups. You wear a lab coat when you perform with Brass Fantasy. How did you start using that as your stage uniform?
Well, I started using I've used a lot of different ones. I've been a priest, I've been a hard hat, but the white jacket kind of stands for research, and I've been a researcher, and I consider the stage as my laboratory.
You always look to me like the mad scientist when you wear it. You know, that you're cooking something up in your laboratory.
Yeah, Jack Sheldon once told me that I was there. It was like a psychiatrist gone berserk or something.
Let me change the subject to the Art Ensemble of Chicago. What part of your playing and your personality does that group bring out?
Well, the Art Ensemble is the artistic, the research, the multi-ethnic, influential, heavy. I believe this is the most difficult music that I play is with the Art Ensemble. I can play things with the Art Ensemble that everyone else wouldn't know what to do, but just hold their eyes open wide. So it's the most advanced musically of all the groups.
Did you think of yourself as being an avant-garde player when you helped form the group in 1965?
No, we didn't. We never considered ourselves avant-garde. I mean, people considered us avant-garde. We've been trying to live that down now for the last 25 years. So it's because avant-garde has a sort of a negative connotation. When people think of avant-garde, it means something that they're going to have difficulty understanding, something that's going to be maybe chaotic and avant-garde doesn't really mean that. It means just something that's a little bit ahead of its time. It doesn't necessarily mean it's atonal or it's a bunch of confusing sounds that may be difficult to decipher. So it's kind of hard to live that down, and that label was kind of stuck on us.
Well, the Art Ensemble is really a group that not only plays, you know, challenging music, but they, you know, it's a group that really knows how to have fun, and that is also like Brass Fantasy into theatricality. Most of the members of the Art Ensemble of Chicago wear face paint for performances. I believe you usually don't.
I sweat too much. I had that paint all in my mouth. It'd be all down in my horn, up in my nose. So I don't use it.
Was there ever any pressure on you to do it so that you'd fit in with the way everybody else was?
No, making? There's no pressure to fit in, because if you fit in with the Art Ensemble, you fit out.
Right.
Because it's about being individual, and it's about expressing yourself any way you want to. The whole idea of the paint is the tradition of the mask, and in order to prepare yourself to play music, you try to put yourself on another level. You want to become out of yourself, become the music itself, you know? And to do this, it requires changing something. I don't want to look the same way I look walking down the street as I do when I walk on the stage, because on the stage is when I'm presenting my craft and when I really have to concentrate and get into what I'm doing. And the change of costumes, the paint, all of this helps.
How did you join the Art Ensemble? Or I should say, how did you co-found it?
Well, what happened is I moved to Chicago. I was married at that time to Fontella Bass, and she got a hit called Rescue Me, and we moved to Chicago. And after playing in the studios and doing the jingles for about a year, I heard about Richard Abrams' experimental band, and I went and sat in with their experimental band, and the next day I was a member of the ACM, and Roscoe Mitchell and Joseph Jarman and I were all rehearsing together.
It must have seemed like a big leap at the time for you musically?
No, not actually. You have to understand that you don't go from bag to bag in this music. You don't say, well, I'm jazz and I'm R&B. I've always wanted to be a jazz musician. I've never wanted to be anything other than a jazz musician, but I also knew that I may have had to be a country and western musician to survive until I could play jazz for a living. So it all works together. One helps the other. I mean, my R&B experience helps me right now. My jazz experience helps me when I go to India or to Africa to play. You know, if you can play bebop, you can play just about anything. You know all the patterns of just about any music in the world. So I can use my bebop experience to help me play Chinese music. I can use the Chinese experience to help me further enhance or play something new on something else. So it all works together. You don't try to be just, you know, it's not just like one at a time. I'm R&B for a couple of years and I'm into jazz. It all kind of fuses together.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Jazz trumpeter Lester Bowie speaking to Terry Gross in 1989. Next month marks the 10th anniversary of his death at the age of 58. A tribute concert takes place tonight in San Francisco at the Herbst Theater. I Only Have Eyes for You, recorded by the late, great Lester Bowie. Oren Peli's horror film Paranormal Activity cost $15,000 to make and features unknown actors. After festival screenings, it was picked up by Paramount Pictures for national distribution. The studio mounted a campaign to build word of mouth with midnight shows across the country. Those were sold out. Now it's expanding to many cities, and you can see it anytime. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
As the Blair Witch Project prove, nothing is scarier than nothing. Forget monsters, vampires. Think of darkness and the crack of a twig nearby. You freeze. You wait. It's the waiting that makes Paranormal Activity nearly unbearable, even if, like me, you love to be scared. When something on screen actually happens, it's like any other dumb horror picture. It's very conventional in the light of day. But, of course, we're not seeing things by the light of day. As in Blair Witch, the perspective is radically limited. There's no omniscient point of view. We watch everything through the video camera of Mika, a day trader played by Mika Sloat. He comes home to his suburban San Diego house with his new toy after his live-in girlfriend Katie, played by Katie Featherston, reports noises in the night. An alien presence.
High def camera on. My girlfriend Katie, she thinks there's something in the house. I don't know.
You believe me, right?
I think we're going to have a very interesting time capturing whatever paranormal phenomena is occurring or is not occurring.
Here's the scariest part. Director Oren Peli's genius gimmick. Mika sets up the camera to record when they sleep. The view is of their bed and the door and the dark hall leading to the stairway. The image is pale, greenish and white. There's a timer on the screen. You see 1:32 a.m. and 40 seconds, 41, 42, 43, and then there's a low rumble. On some nights, there might be a faint sound of walking or running. Often Katie and Mika don't wake up, although they watch the footage the next day on a computer. But sometimes there's a thud or a crash, and Mika grabs the camera and walks into the hall, a little orb of light illuminating a corner, a railing, or pointing down the stairs into the darkness. A psychic, played by Mark Fredericks, specializes in ghosts, which he says are ex-humans, whereas this is likely a demon, non-human, evil. He gives them the phone number of a demonologist. Katie wants to call, but Mika doesn't. He's a macho man. He yells things into the darkness like, "Is that all you got?" After a while, the audience decides he's a moron. We think, "Call the demonologist, Katie, please." Paranormal Activity is weakest when it's most explicit, which increasingly it is. Even a recognizable shadow, or a door swinging shut, or bed covers rising up, dilute the dread. This is not a great ghost story on the order of The Innocents or the original The Haunting. It's not even as irrationally terrifying as The Blair Witch Project. But Peli is very shrewd in how he uses the microscopic budget and single setting to make us feel trapped and to exploit our anticipation. Every time he cut to another night and the timer appeared, I said out loud, "Oh, God, here we go," as well as words I can't say on the radio. Lights click on and off. Katie gets out of bed and stands, just stands by the side of the bed as the timer runs in fast motion to show she hasn't budged for an hour. Is she awake? Is something holding her? Throughout this movie, something sure as hell is holding us.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.